morning. This is Hugh LaFont, your host for Fridays and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Morris Dickstein, professor of English at the City University of New York Graduate Center, and we're discussing his book, Leopards in the Temple, The Transformation of American Fiction, 1945 to 1970. Morris, glad to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
I wonder if you could begin by giving the listener a brief sense of your aims in Leopards in the Temple.
Well, my aims changed as I was working on it. This really began as a book on the fiction writers who emerged in the 25 years after the war, but I found as I read and reread them that I couldn't deal with the fiction itself, that there were other things that were happening in the other arts, that were happening in film, that were happening in jazz, that were happening on the stage, that were happening in the larger society in general that really bore very heavily on what was happening in the fiction. In order to make sense of the fiction, I found that I had to do a kind of social and cultural history of this period of the quarter century after the war. Now, some of that period I'd already written about in an earlier book on the 1960s called Gates of Eden. And in that period, partly because I believed it and partly out of a rhetorical convenience, one of the things that I often did was to set off the cultural explosions of the 60s against what seemed to be the quieter, more conservative period that I and many other people associated with the 1950s. But as I read more and more towards this book, I found that so much of what I had associated with the 60s really had its roots, sometimes very small roots and sometimes very large ones, in the period that began right after the war. And so it became clear to me that the real watershed moment in American culture was not so much 1960 or the late 50s as I'd previously thought, but really it was 1945 when the war ended and really America turned towards a society very different from both the war and from the depression that had preceded it. And what surprised me also was that since so many people felt that fiction had not been such a major part of post-war culture as it perhaps had been earlier, how much of these social changes came through in the fiction, not only in the subjects that the fiction writers were dealing with, but in the kinds of novels they wrote, in the forms of the novels, and the way they attacked their subjects, and who they had telling the stories, and the kinds of characters they dealt with. And all of that seemed both interesting in a literary sense, and I want to stress that, because these are writers who are in many ways are still with us today. People like Mailer and Salinger are still being read today as if they just published these books yesterday, but also interesting in a cultural and social sense in terms of what they tell us about the new world that emerged, you know, after the war and in many ways is still with us today.
All right, let's look a little bit at that explanation, and then after we've talked in a more general way about it, maybe look at some of the periods and particular authors that you discuss. You see the war as playing an especially important role, as you describe that it's the watershed moment in at least 1900 American history. What was it that the war did? Why did it make such a difference?
Well, the most important thing, of course, was that it brought the Depression to an end. As historians have long understood, with all the good work that was done by Roosevelt and the New Deal, by the end of the 1930s, the Depression had only been partly alleviated. It was not as bad as the terrible winter of 1932-33, but there was still a very high level of unemployment and so on. And what happened was that it was the shift to war production that paradoxically pulled the country, especially the economy, of course, out of the Depression. Now, there were many other consequences at the same time. America had always been, to a degree, an isolationist country, and this forced America into a world role and onto the world stage much more than it during World War One. Our participation in World War One had only come towards the end of the war. We had pulled back afterwards and refused to join the League of Nations, and essentially pulled back in the 20s towards the old Fortress America kind of isolation that we'd had before. This was not only not possible after World War II, it was not desirable. What I just described was America's role as a whole, but of course, when you look at it closely, this was also true for people in their individual lives. People were uprooted from small towns and cities where they had lived their entire lives. sometimes they'd lived their entire lives in just neighborhoods of cities, in Jewish or Italian neighborhoods of a large city. And they were thrown together with other groups. The impact was especially great on blacks, for example, who were, of course, they were in a segregated army, but they were, you know, pulled out of rural areas or ghettos and fighting a war that was meant to end the form of racism and discrimination. And they were not really willing to go back to a world of segregation and discrimination after the war. So not only did the war give them tremendously complicated new experiences and much more cosmopolitan experiences, but it made them unhappy with the world that sometimes they were asked to be returned to. It altered their expectations, and this had a tremendous effect on American society. Now, we should also add, of course, that the war was proved tremendously violent. Millions and millions of people were killed. The war ended with revelations about a kind of violence that people were not even aware of, which was, you know, the Holocaust and the death camps. And so the war not only altered people's expectations in terms of their lives, but it also amazingly altered their conception of what the human being was made of, what man was, what was a kind of, they saw a kind of darkness and violence in the heart of man that perhaps certain Catholics and Freudians had understood, but most people had not really understood. And this really altered their conception of man. So the war, in this and many other ways, had a very dramatic impact.
So it's important really in two ways, broadly speaking. One is it actually dramatically changed the economic and political climate of the United States and our relation to the rest of the world.
Yes,
but it also changed people's sense of themselves, who they were, how they were to understand their own identity, their relationship with other people. And it's this combination of factors that makes the end of the war so dramatic and sets the stage for the fiction, which is the focus
right.
of the book.
I think after the war, people ended up living a kind of strangely bifocal existence, because on the one hand, you know, there were serious predictions that since the war had ended the Depression, what would happen, you know, when all these men returned into the job market after the war? Well, maybe the Depression would return. So there were fears about the economy after the war, which turned out to be untrue. The U.S. had entered into one of its greatest periods of prosperity. On the other hand, there was this perception about the nature of man, this sense of this inner violence as well as external violence that people had seen. So this created this strangely split culture after the war. On the one hand, a culture of consumerism, of return, of home and family, of moving to the suburbs, of building our own lives and achieving a certain prosperity that people had not been able to pursue, at least since 1929. At the same time, in the back of their minds was all the things that they had seen and experienced, which was a sense that perhaps underneath this world of getting and spending, under a kind of thin, brittle surface, there were fierce and violent energies that were at work and could potentially break out again. Now, this was especially marked because, in a way, with the Cold War coming on so soon after the end of the war, that the U.S. remained on a sort of mobilized wartime battle footing, and the Cold War added to this complication of feelings that people experienced in their post-war lives.
Let's move on and begin to look at some of the distinctive periods, styles of writing that occurred during that period, because at each stage, I think it nicely illustrates so many of the points that you just made in a more concrete way. Could you just briefly summarize what you consider the major developments or periods within this quarter of a century?
Well, in the writing, certainly, you know, the first important development was people writing about their experiences in the war. And here, you know, some really important war novels were produced, like Mailer's The Naked and the Dead or James Jones's From Here to Eternity. They tended to be done in a rather conservative style, which is that writers like that, trying to give a wartime canvas, trying to describe what was like in battle or in the world just before the battle in the army, tended to reach back to the techniques of the naturalistic novel of before the war, describing platoons, describing invasions, describing conflicts and solidarities among the men who were in the army. And these were more or less equivalent to the naturalistic or proletarian techniques that had been used in the social and economic novels before the war. So this was, I think, quite important. On the other hand, that new sense of man, that arbitrary sense of what man was made of, you know, that sense of the inner violence, infiltrated these fictions so that often there were elements of absurdity, of a kind of insanity that occurred in these often carefully planned wartime campaigns that ultimately came to fruition not immediately after the war, but in the novels that were written 10, 15, 20 years later, like Catch-22 or James Jones's later novel, A Thin Red Line, where you get almost a kind of existentialist war novel as opposed to a battle campaign novel, a novel about the insanity of war rather than, you might say, the strategies and the progress of war. And this represented two interesting stages of our culture as expressed in two stages of the war novel itself. Simultaneously with the war novels, there were other writers who were writing books that were perhaps a fifth the length of a war novel. They were tended to be very short, very personal novels that were really about individuals doing what a lot of other people were doing in the period immediately after the war, which was trying to create lives for themselves, to pursue meaning in their lives, to pursue some sort of inner satisfaction or happiness in relationships with other people. And these novels were very personal rather than social novels. They were often very beautifully crafted. They often involved very young protagonists. Of course, a good example would be The Catcher in the Rye. And many people at the time felt that these were very apolitical novels, that they withdrew from the larger political context of the pre-war novels or the war novels, and were sort of escapist novels with very, very small themes and subjects. But I think as I looked into these books and reread them, I found that in a way they were more radical than the war novels, that these books were using their young protagonists to reject almost society as a whole, something that is even beyond social criticism. They were seeing the whole structure of society as false, as phony, as restrictive. And they were doing something that was parallel to a lot of the social critics of the period, people like William White in The Organization Man or David Riesman in The Lonely Crowd, which was seeing society as a kind of plot against the individual, which made the individual, made it very difficult for the individual to achieve the kind of personal happiness that seemed to have been the promise of American life. So these, I think, were two very important developments, you know, immediately after the war. There were others, you know, there were others that followed. I think the great influences right after the war on writing were writers, earlier writers like Kafka and Dostoevsky for this darker side of the literature, and at the same time, a writer like Walt Whitman for a more open, more expansive kind of novel that also developed after the war, that perhaps is epitomized by the work of the Beats, especially Kerouac's On the Road. And so you have a version in literature of the sort of kind of bifocal existence that I describe people in general living, which is to say, on the one hand, there was a great cultural expansion, a sense of freedom, a sense of new possibility that was very, very well expressed in these Whitmanesque novels. On the other hand, there was a fear, there was an anxiety, a sense of entrapment, a sense of a kind of heart of darkness that was expressed in the work of other writers, a writer, for example, like Bernard Malamud, who happens to be a favorite of mine, that were very much influenced by writers like Kafka and Dostoevsky, which were saying that man had very little freedom, that the world would always sort of conspire against us and limit us, and all our goals and aims might tend to come to naught. And sometimes it was the very same writers who were in alternate works were writing, you know, one or the other kinds of books, so that a writer like Saul Bellow in The Adventures of Augie March could write an extremely expansive Whitmanesque novel glorying in sort of man's freedom to try to find himself in this new open period after the war. And then a couple of years later, turn around and write his brilliant short novel, Seize the Day, about how all attempts to do this are doomed to failure, and that we're essentially the people that we wanted to transcend, and that we will never, never get out of the box of our own identity. So, I mean, all in all, this led me to feel that the simplified views that people had, both of post-war culture and also of post-war writing were completely untrue, that it was a rich, complex period and essentially a period of transition where there were many trends that would only come to fruition later in the 60s and beyond.
Let's just briefly talk about two of the themes which you did mention, which seem to come up in several of these kinds of novels. One is this preoccupation with, or maybe that's a pejorative term, a special concern about a personal identity, who I am, at least in this current world. And you talk, for example, about a certain kind of existentialist leanings or impressions that come through in at least some of this literature. If you want to talk about that too, it might be helpful to explain what existentialism is very briefly for the benefit of the listener.
Existentialism, I think, as it was understood after the war, was the idea that human life is contingent, that it's full of uncertainty, but also that we are responsible for making our own values, for making our own lives, for creating our own identity. I think existentialism emerged really from the French Resistance during the war, when in a period of repression and dictatorship and Nazi occupation of France, certain writers, paradoxically like Sartre or Camus, developed a notion of human freedom that had to do with the fact that we were all vulnerable. We couldn't count on God to help us or save us. We couldn't count on any ideas of transcendence or permanent or absolute values. But essentially, our lives were what we chose to make them to be. And there's a famous remark in Sartre that we always have some freedom, that even in the worst situation, we have the freedom to commit suicide. Now, that's a very limited kind of freedom, but it's an example of the kind of freedom that Sartre saw available to human beings in a baleful and vulnerable and dangerous and even hemmed-in situation. Now, this didn't entirely come to America from France. There were American writers in the late 30s, like Richard Wright, who were, you might say, instinctive existentialists, and who in Richard Wright's novel Native Son, talks about, someone who had killed a woman and killed two women and been condemned to death, and nevertheless, within that condemnation, in prison, comes to a sense of his own freedom, that for the first time he's done something that made a meaningful gesture out of which he's achieved his own identity. And so existentialism in that respect fed into the writers after the war by feeding, you might say, their introspection. During the war in France, among the resistance, it may have been a license for a sort of activism, but the way it was reinterpreted in America by writers after the war was that simultaneously we're creatures in danger, dangling in the wind, vulnerable, but at the same time, the fact that we can't count on anyone or anything outside ourselves, and certainly can't count on any transcendent powers, gives us the option to create our own moral values, to achieve an identity that has to be made by ourselves, that can't be given to us by our parents or by society. And so you get all these novels that are really much more personal than the pre-war novel, novels in which people probe their inner lives, their identity, their relationships in terms of finding out who or what they are. And while on the surface these seem to be strictly personalized, the values that these writers look for or find, writers like Salinger or Kerouac, really tend to be very critical of the society as a whole, which tends to promulgate false identities or to create situations that prevent us from becoming the people that we really have the potential to become. And so my argument in this book is that this form of personalization that's so important to the fiction writers after the war, this form of existentialism that has always been seen as apolitical, really is obliquely a form of radical social criticism. And so the radicalism that we associate, for example, with the youth culture of the 1960s really originates in these threads of youth culture and other aspects of the arts and culture in the 40s and 50s. It's all an anticipation and a transition.
Okay, the other thing which you mentioned, which seems to me to be connected to that one, is really a series of issues, I suppose, that concern prosperity. I mean, you might think, and obviously I think most Americans did think, that once prosperity came, our problems would somehow disappear. And yet many of these novelists talk about ways in which prosperity not only has not solved our problems, but actually created some new ones.
Well, of course, even these writers who are very socially critical, you know, prosperity gives them the potential to make these personal moves that I just described. In other words, in a period of economic want like the Depression, writers and people in general do not usually have the luxury of navel-gazing. They don't have the luxury of spending a lot of time probing their own identity. It's the economic and social issues that seem primary. So the very criticism of prosperity that develops after the war, in a sense, is made possible by the prosperity, the social expansion itself. A writer, for example, like Kerouac, who is eulogizing this cross-country travel and this freedom that's involved, this freedom from family responsibilities, freedom from domesticity, freedom from living in a strict suburban life, of course, is doing so partly because the prosperity makes this kind of mobility possible as it was not before the war. Nevertheless, these writers are very, very critical of American materialism because, you might say, as in most existentialism, there's a kind of religious current. In other words, they feel that the more prosperous that we are, the more material our material lives are, our problems are solved in that area, the more rich we are, the more consumer goods we can afford to buy, the more likely it is that we will live lives that are soulless and hollow and in some deep way empty and unsatisfying. And so the writers both take advantage of prosperity and ride on a wave of prosperity, and at the same time feel that there's something empty about it. If we're doing so well, why isn't it more fun? Why isn't it giving us more satisfaction? And this is what a lot of the novels are about, a kind of emptiness of the post-war prosperity.
And so, this really is crucial to your thesis that the 50s was not just a period in which people laid back both culturally and in literature, but literally paved the way with what was going to follow in the 60s by providing that intertern, by providing this sort of critique of prosperity, which became perhaps more apparent in the 60s.
Right. I think there is really a deep vein of social criticism in works that do not seem overtly social critical. In other words, it's clear that writers like David Reisman or William White are writing strong and unremitting social criticism. The period in sociology and in popular sociology was the golden age of social criticism. But if you look at the literature or the other arts, you find it there as well. For example, you look at what happened in drama after the war, the role of method acting in terms of looking for a sort of personal authenticity in performance, the new plays by writers like Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller that really depended on method acting for their immediacy and reality. These project an idea of personal authenticity that people felt was not being realized in the prosperous society as a whole. This is what Holden Caulfield is constantly saying in The Catcher in the Rye, that everything about him is phony, it's empty, that people are unreal, that people are exploitative. And so, as I say, this personal turn took on a lot of the characteristics of an oblique social criticism, especially when they involved, you might say, youthful characters up against the world, characters like the Beats or characters like Holden Caulfield, who saw in the unspoiled world of childhood and youth values that were being disrespected or obliterated in the larger maturity imposed by American society in the 50s.
Okay, and the people who define this period, I think this really is connected with the metaphor laying behind the title of your book. The people who wrote in this period were in many senses outsiders. They weren't part of the literary mainstream, and yet they became the literary mainstream.
Well, this is socially, in terms of who the writers were and where they came from, they're a very different group from what we had been familiar with before the war or earlier. It's true that in many ways the writers of the 20s were outsiders, in the sense that people like Hemingway, Scott Fitzgerald, Sinclair Lewis, you know, came from the Midwest. They felt like rubes in the big city. And they brought to a degree a provincial and rural perspective into the larger culture. But that was not as drastically different as a writer like Kerouac, who had not spoken, was from French-Canadian parents, had not spoken a word of English before the age of six. A writer like Saul Bellow, whose parents had just emigrated from Russia a year or two before he was born, had grown up in a rough-and-tumble world, first of Montreal, then of Chicago, had grown up in a Yiddish-speaking family. Writers like Chester Himes, who, although he had middle-class parents, had been convicted of armed robbery in the 1930s, began writing when he was in a penitentiary in Ohio. Now, these writers were outsiders in a rather drastic fashion, and I think they brought to American literature a rather different set of values. First of all, they were much less genteel. They had no relation at all to the American genteel tradition. Second of all, just as the World War II generation had brought violence as a subject to the fore in a way that we hadn't seen in American literature before, it brought a focus on sexuality that these outsider writers were willing to grapple the way writers who came from the genteel tradition were unwilling or unable to do. And so it brought... It not only was a new cast of characters in American literature, but they were willing to deal with a new set of interests that were much more cutting edge and much more dangerous and much more thrilling than what American literature had been dealing with before the war.
Okay, I'm wondering if the last minute and a half you might give the listener and myself included a list of your favorites, if you were going to pick out the 5-8 books that from this period that you think were especially both good fiction and also important for defining the period, what would they be?
Saul Bellow's novella Seize the Day is one of the most perfect books of the post-war period, a rather grim book, but one with a beautiful ending. I would say that one of my discoveries in the book was Tennessee Williams' short stories, which could easily be found in a collection of his called The Collected Stories. Beautiful, shaped, wonderful, direct notations of experience, and a writer that we associate more with his plays. I would include a novel like Revolutionary Road by Richard Yates, which seems to me the ultimate statement about the young suburban couples who try to make a life for themselves after the war and felt a sense of deep disappointment. I would include in such a list a book like Norman Mailer's Advertisements for Myself or The Armies of the Night, where Mailer breaks through to a new style and either in a comic or horrendous fashion tries to really go beyond anything that he or any other writer had done before in terms of self-examination, in terms of dealing with violence, finding a new way of writing in order to do so. I would send readers to a book like Chester Himes' If He Hollers, Let Him Go, which is a terrific evocation of the blacks and during the war working in the defense industries in the L.A. area. Chester Himes is not a writer who's just widely read enough.
Wonderful list. I appreciate talking to you on the phone, and I'm glad you appeared on the show.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
And speaking today with Morris Dickstein, professor of English at the City University of New York Graduate Center, we've been discussing his book, Leopards in the Temple. This is Hugh Follett for Ideas and Issues. Good day.